Well, good day and welcome to the Disaster Podcast. Another episode here for you this week. I'm your host, Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic, and we are really excited to be jumping in with another episode for you. And we are going to be talking about, of course, all things response and disaster related. And we've got a really special guest for you tonight. But before we get into that, though, I want to talk and introduce, as always, my co-host, Sam Bradley. Sam, the newly minted dog sitter, I guess, right?
Yes, I'm so excited. I didn't even realize my background is past Rover, and I got my first two dogs, and they're really awesome dogs. So I'm having a lot of fun because now I'm not without dogs for a while. I'm going to hate to see these guys go. So yeah, I think this is, I can have fun, and I actually get paid, so it's a good thing. We don't have Kyle tonight. He's on some secret mission that takes him out of cell phone range, but I did want to kind of mention a very serious weather-related disaster in progress, and that's huge rains, floods, and a mudslide in Sierra Leone. There's still 600 missing. They know 300 are reported dead, and there was an interesting comment someone made, said the magnitude of the destruction as a result of the disaster is such that the number of victims in the community who may not come out alive, like exceed the number of dead bodies already recovered. Unfortunately, all our resources are stretched. Their local mortuary has four ambulances. So clearly that's not going to work. 60 children died, unfortunately. So, they had like 20 inches more of rain than normal that just came up really fast. And 3,000 people are left homeless, and you know those figures are going to go up. So, Joe, as a USAR guy, is there some chance some of our teams might be involved with this?
I've not heard anything about that specifically. In other words, there's been no request or alert. So that would say to me that there's been no request for, you know, international resources come out of Sierra Leone at this point. But, you know, we would certainly be up for something like that. That's very much like the Oso mudslide that we have dealt with before. So I think the issue with that is that I don't know a lot about the details of the structures that are involved in the mudslide. I know it was kind of in the outskirts of and around the capital city, but you know, if it's anything like Oso, there was pretty much no rescue. It was all recovery work because everyone was buried under, you know, 50 feet of mud. Sounds very similar. I just don't know if there are large structures involved that might allow for some void spaces and that sort of stuff.
Yeah, well, it'll be interesting to see what happens, and I feel for all those people out there. And as usual, when you get an area that doesn't have or has the type of homes that, well, I was going to say, it probably doesn't matter what your home's made out of when you get that volume of water and mud. It's just, you know, it can happen here as well. And interestingly, we've had a couple guests regarding the Oso mudslide, and it was fascinating. It really was. So anyway, we will move on to something more local. I have Mike Newton with us, and we actually had a nice chat on the phone. And Mike and I know we know each other because he's with the team, the DMAT I actually started with. We just haven't figured out exactly where we crossed paths, but we will one of these days. But Mike wrote the book that I was supposed to have written years ago that I've been thinking about since Katrina and never got around to. Only his focus is more on the international aspect. So, Mike, why don't you tell him a little about yourself and what you do, and then we'll talk about some specifics.
Great. Well, I wanted to thank everybody for having me. It's an honor to be on the podcast, and I'm a couple episodes behind. I'm up to the first podcast on the volunteers in Iraq, and it was awesome, but I'm honored to be in the group of people you guys have been interviewing. So my background was about 15 years in the fire service as a paramedic, and then I kind of got up into middle management as a lieutenant. And then about 5 or 6 years ago, I switched over to public health emergency management. Those are the people who are planning for anthrax, Ebola, earthquakes, anything that would affect the public health system. And like everybody in EMS, I've got, you know, spoons in 9 different pots. So I'm also on a DMAT, a disaster medical assistance team, one of the federal teams that we Sam just mentioned. And then I had the chance to go overseas 4 or 5 times in the last 7 or 8 years as a medical volunteer. And that's where the book came from. So firefighter, paramedic for those 15 years, probably, I was thinking about it, paramedic for 21, 22 years now. It kind of makes me get a little bit misty-eyed. It's been a long time, but that's what led me to those volunteer experiences and led me into writing the book.
Well, I got a few years on you, bud. Quite a few, as a matter of fact. So don't feel too bad. But, you know, so I think my first question is, when you did that first international deployment, what was it that you felt completely gobsmacked about that you thought, you know, there needs to be a reference for this kind of thing?
Well, it was kind of a vicious cycle, and I hope anybody who listens to this podcast and they hear these amazingly experienced people you guys are talking to go, they feel, you know, overwhelmed or that they don't bring anything to the table, and that's not true. But I did find when the Haiti earthquake hit, that it was a bit of a, I didn't have experience, and these large groups wanted someone with experience, international experience, but you can't get experience without having experience. So I was kind of caught in that catch-22. I was able to find a smaller group to deploy to Haiti to for about 2.5 weeks, and I worked in a field hospital with them as a paramedic. But my first week or two of calling and reaching out to organizations and emailing, I got a bit of a stone wall thrown up, and that's okay. I mean, they're putting you into an austere environment that they don't know you, and they really want someone who's highly dependable. But how do you get that experience? How do you prove to them that you're dependable? So that was that first deployment to Haiti after the Port-au-Prince earthquake a number of years ago. Then I came back, and I went over to the Philippines after Typhoon Haiyan, and I worked with a different medical team for about 14 days there. I came back, and then I went to Nepal to the more recent earthquake. I think that was April 2 years ago, the major earthquake that struck Nepal, and deployed with a medical team to there. So, and I am plugging the book because it's a project of my heart for someone, especially a student or someone who's a retiree or who just doesn't know where to start. It does have a kind of a step-by-step process where you think what you're interested in. Is it medical? Is it water purification? Is it radio and comms? And what area do I want to be with? What kind of organization? What kind of training? What kind of equipment? All the way through the deployment period to coming back, and how you're going to deal with the psychological after effects of returning from a disaster scene, and then you're kind of plunked back in your normal day-to-day life. So I'm plugging the book because I wrote it from my heart, and I think it has a really a step-by-step process. I will say that I'm not getting rich from it. So it's not to get rich. It is just that I was that person about 8 or 9 years ago that said, man, I saw this big thing happen on the news. I want to get out there and help. I have skills, whether they're EMT skills or paramedic skills or nursing skills. That's my background is medical. But maybe you know a lot about building construction and you feel like you could help there, or satellite phones or drones or something. But how can I find a group that can use my skills? So that's kind of, I wish I'd had a system, and I kind of worked out a way on my own. So anybody out there who's listening to that, you certainly, I'll give you all the information I can in the next 25 or 30 minutes, but also check out the book if you want the whole picture that I came up with.
We'll make sure that we talk more about that, and Jamie can put some info up on it. But, you know, when you talk about Haiti, that was our first international deployment that nobody really expected to go on as a DMATter. And I remember when the call came out, check your passports, and I realized mine was actually like 10 days short of expiring. And I said, well, guess I'm not going, but my team certainly did. And Joe, was that your first international deployment with USARC? Turn your mute off, Joe. He forgets to do that.
Thank you. I did forget to do that. No, it was not my first. My first was a hurricane in Florida, like, I don't know, you know. I don't even remember Charlie or George or, you know, something way back.
Yeah.
Or
someplace.
Wow. Well, I had a similar experience. It's funny that you had that. I was going to the Philippines as a paramedic, and my passport expired in 5.5 months. And the Philippines, like many countries, have a rule that you are not allowed to visit if your passport doesn't have at least 6 months eligibility on it. So I got to the airport a year ago, knowing that I had a valid passport. And then when the airline checked my passport, they said, here, why don't you sit down? We're going to call Manila and see if you can actually go on this. We know that you're coming as part of a medical team. We know that you hopefully are responding to this disaster, but there are rules in place. So I don't. I had this kind of a similar experience to Sam. Now, they did a waiver for me, and they did allow me to deploy. But it's those little, I think, tricks of the trade that we've all kind of picked up on over the years.
Well, you're right, and that's one little great tip. In fact, I think mine is good till 19, but, you know, you check those things, because we really got caught not realizing that we were going to go on that deployment, and a lot of us went, oh, oops, should have paid more attention to this. So tell us a little bit about getting on DMAT and kind of what made you think that was a good thing to do, and maybe some of the other organizations you chose to be with.
Sure. So DMAT, if people aren't familiar with it, those are probably about 60 or so roughly federal teams that are across the country. And you're basically a volunteer until you're called up to deploy to either a disaster or a major national event. And an example of some of the national events I've gone to were the 2012 presidential inauguration. They have a number of medical teams along the parade route, and we staffed those tents along the way. I also went to one of the State of the Union addresses where they had medical teams in the Capitol building in case of any kind of, probably a terrorist attack, I guess, was the major threat that they were evaluating for. The process, like anything involving the federal government, and I say this with a great deal of love, is a long and somewhat painful process.
Joe knows that one.
You're basically becoming an intermittent federal employee. So you find an opening on, I believe it's USAjobs.gov, when those positions open up through the DMAT, the DMAT teams, and you apply for it. You wait for 4 or 5 or 6 or 7 months while HR evaluates you. If you are accepted, you are fingerprinted. They do a background check. They check your credentials, medical credentials. Probably out of the 50 or 60 people that are on each team, you know, 80% are medical, but they do have logistics people, communications people, command people. So that's the process. It took me about a year and a half to get on a team, and it seemed like a good fit. I will say, as I was chatting with someone yesterday, telling her that the teams don't go out, but maybe every year or two or three. If you guys have different experiences, I'd love to hear them. But, you know, we're a federal team. We're pretty expensive to deploy. They are paying us once we're deployed. They're giving us a lot of expensive equipment. So they don't go out for small incidents. It has to be a Hurricane Sandy, a Hurricane Katrina. Obviously, the earthquake in Haiti was one of the pretty rare times that they went overseas. But so if you're looking to be deployed every 6 or 8 months, DMAT is probably not the way to go. There are a lot of smaller groups that are out there, disaster groups. Some of them are faith-based. So if you are comfortable with a faith-based group, you find a faith-based group. If you want to find a non-denominational one, a non-aligned one, that's cool too. I think the internet, of course, is our friend for searching disaster teams and going from there.
Well, and as you know, California is rather unique in the respect that, because it was a project I worked on, they have a state disaster medical team that actually is composed of a lot of federal medical team members that would deploy within the state. And that kind of helps because, you know, you talk about the last time you deployed, I was a single resource to Sandy, and that was, what, back in 2009? So it's been a while. And I think you're making a good point. You're not going to deploy that often because it's got to be a big one and it's got to be a federal declaration, as with the USAR. So, but at least with having the state team as a resource, it's a nonprofit. That gives us something else to do. We go work wildland fires and some things. And there's the constant training process, which brings us all together. And, you know, so there's something to be said for that. But, you know, if there's people that need immediate, I got to go right now and whatever, that's not going to work for you. Would you agree with that, Joe?
Yeah, I would definitely agree with that. You know, it is a rather extended process. I think getting started is absolutely the hardest part of the whole thing. There's lots of hoops to jump through, lots of basic training before FEMA or the federal government or, you know, whatever entity you're working for decides that you're safe enough to be out in that environment without hurting yourself or others. But that is the hardest part. You got to jump through a bunch of hoops up front and get all that stuff done. And after that, it's much easier and much less time consuming.
So an important question. Oh, go ahead, Mike.
Go ahead. No, I was just saying it's something that's come up in my life. As you evaluate what kind of group you want to go for and what kind of mission you want to support, I think looking around at your personal situation, I had a good conversation with my wife when the Ebola crisis was really hitting Africa, and I said, hey, I've got a chance that I could go over and work as a paramedic with a group in Africa, fighting the Ebola situation. And my wife said, we've got a young baby here at home, and you can't bring back earthquake with you. You can't bring back hurricane with you. But, you could bring back Ebola, and I'm not super comfortable with that. I'm not giving you an ultimatum, but let's sit down and talk about this. So whether you live alone, you have a roommate, you're in a relationship, talk about your with your employer, et cetera, when you're talking about the group you want to apply with. So subsequent to that, I went to Nepal for the earthquake. Subsequent to that, I got an offer to go to Mosul, like the gentleman you guys interviewed over the last couple of weeks. And I had a similar conversation with my wife, who said, I think I could handle you going to Turkey and maybe working in a refugee camp, but really going right behind the front lines to Iraq, I'd like you to be around for babysitting duties in the next couple of years. So those are the kind of considerations I think come up as you decide what you're comfortable doing and what your family members are comfortable you doing.
Well, and that's a perfect segue to the question I was going to ask you. You have a family, you have young kids. I mean, a lot of people have their kids are up and grown, and so it's kind of a perfect thing for them to do because it gives them something else to focus on. But when you have young kids, and I think you made a perfect point, your family has to be okay with the kind of deployment you're going on. And I know going to Ground Zero, in fact, one of my still best friends who was driving us to the airport was almost in tears because his kids, who were quite young at the time and were watching all of this bad stuff on TV, were crying when he left, going, Daddy, don't go there, don't go there. So, yeah, how do you handle something like that when you really feel you need to go? And, do you just say, well, maybe I shouldn't go to this one? Or certainly in some of the cases you were talking about, but, how do you handle that? How do you handle and juggle all those commitments, work and marriage and kids and disaster?
That's an ongoing discussion that each of us needs to have within our own head, and I think needs to have with the important people in our lives. And to be blunt, I think maybe you guys have experienced it as well. I didn't have one particular extremely traumatic experience. In all my deployments, I was working as a paramedic. I never had to parachute by myself into the middle of something that I wasn't completely unprepared for. But those deployments changed me. I think I came back with just a touch of the post-traumatic stress disorder, came back with a little bit of impatience for day-to-day life and work meetings and having to pay my cell phone bill when I had just left a scene of this kind of intense action and working with people who are injured and really being in the heart of some really intense team. So that's just another thing to kind of realize. It's a cost. That's the cost afterwards that you're going to have to deal with and work with. So I, whether it's seeing a counselor, whether it's seeing someone in your faith, if that's an option for you, whether it's reading books about post-traumatic stress disorder and looking for management techniques. But I think people should go in with their eyes wide open that going into a disaster probably will affect you psychologically. And it's going to be on you if it's a major psychological effect or one that's perhaps, more manageable and you can get through.
Oh, God, that's perfectly said. And that's exactly where I was going to go, because we have talked about this quite a bit. And, Joe, when he talks about his team, his job as the doc is to kind of take care of his team mentally and physically. And the getting back part, people don't understand how hard it is to reassimilate. After Ground Zero, it took us weeks to even begin to reassimilate. So if you don't have a chapter in your book on for families and helping them understand why we may not just care about whether the washing machine is broken or what the kid did last week, it takes us some time for that to be important again. I think that's critical to put those things in. And also for people to understand just what you said, the stresses that you're going to face over there and how you handle them and what you're going to come back with and what you need to do are critical.
I agree, and I would throw out there that there's a psychologist out of University of California, Los Angeles, a guy named Chip Schreiber, who's been he was involved in the mental health response to Sandy Hook, and a number of other awful psychologically traumatic events. And so he created almost a triage system. In fact, it is a triage system for responders while they're in an event, and it's a system of checkboxes. Did you have to operate outside of your practice? Did you have to abandon a patient in kind of in mid-treatment due to changing situations? Was your life in danger during this response? And I think so important during the deployment to constantly ask yourself, because you're in a weird environment, you know, the electricity's not working, you're under constant stress, so you may not be evaluating your own emotional state. And his way is kind of at the end of each day, ask yourself these 12 questions, and you may find that you're receiving psychological trauma that you're not realizing, and at least it makes you aware at the end of the week, at the end of the two-week deployment, however long you're gone, like, wow, I thought I was just working and doing stuff, but, you know, some bad stuff happened here, and I'm going to have to deal with this when I get home.
Yeah, maybe I'd love to get him on the podcast. I've heard of this guy, and I think I've heard of that list, and I think it's a good evaluation, because some of it, you know, it's hard to be honest with yourself, because it's just like being a medic. You know, you're the one that takes care of other people, and so I got to be strong, and nothing can happen to me, and yada, 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 right, Joe?
Oh, absolutely. That's one of the pluses to an objective list like that, is that it sort of forces you to take a look at you know, look inward and judge your own mental health and actually have to write it down as opposed to just telling yourself that you feel fine.
Exactly. Any thoughts, Jamie?
No, I just think it's something we revisit quite a bit on the show is the wellness and well-being of the responder. And it I think it bears in mind, I think Mike's brought up some good things that we need to be honest with ourselves. We need to have some candid and frank conversations with the important people in our lives, both family and at work, in workplaces, about what we're doing and why we're doing it, and help us to be have everybody on board with what we're planning to do, because there could be some effect in the aftermath, whether it's worrying about bringing Ebola back or bringing back the stress of dealing with a major event and coming back to the regular world.
And you may not even realize it for a while until you get back and go, you know, I don't think I'm the same person I was when I left. And I can tell you that from personal experience. So, Mike, a question for you. Was there one thing, did you just wake up at 3 o'clock one morning and go, hey, I think I'm going to write this book? Or was there something that set that in motion? Or was it just a general, there isn't one and there needs to be because Sam never wrote that? How did that happen?
Well, I was lucky. I was speaking at a conference, the International Association of Emergency Managers, and about this topic, about... Well, I think the value of people who are in emergency management in the United States of going to experience a disaster someplace else and helping out with someone else's disaster would make you a better emergency manager here in the United States. And how would someone start? Again, that vicious cycle of if you don't have experience, how do you get experience? And to my good fortune, there was a representative from a publishing company listening to the talk, and she said, are you aware of a book on how to become an international disaster volunteer? And I said, no. And she said, would you like to write one? And I said, well, I become extremely rich. And she said, no. And those are all true. So I, over the next year and a half, which was also when my first child was being born, I wrote at 3 or 4 in the morning for 2 hours, a chapter here and a chapter there. But I did, it was, as I said, I wish this book had been out 8 or 9 years ago when I started to get into the field. And it's just how to start when you don't know where to start.
Exactly. Well, a good question for Jim on that, since we got the Sasquatch actually on the podcast. It's been a while. But one thing that Mike and I talked about offline is that emergency managers don't really, they're more politicians than they are responders. They don't really understand a lot about response. And, you know, his suggestion when we chatted about it was maybe these guys need to be responders. Maybe they need to get out, boots on the ground, and kind of learn what really goes on out there. And you deal a lot with these guys. What do you think, Jim?
I think, well, thanks for having me. I think that's a true statement. So there's two types of emergency managers. One that you talked about, that's the liaison, and that's perfectly their role, right, between administration and the field. However, to get a real sense of what's going on, a lot of emergency managers these days are coming from the fire and EMS ranks as well. So I think there's not a fair balance yet, but I think you get a more of appreciation of because sometimes what happens is that with emergency managers that don't have the background coming into it, it allows them to think that they are in a command role when really they're in a coordination role to support the field in their endeavors.
Wow. So has anybody read or written a book for emergency managers to help them better understand what they need to know about disaster response? And I'll throw that out to anybody that might have an answer, because I don't know.
I have not read such, but I think it's a great idea. Jamie, what do you think? We'll get together and do that, huh?
Yeah, I think that would be great. I think that's something maybe Sam could jump on. Maybe everybody here could contribute to it.
Yeah, maybe even get Mike involved. I think, we all have a different set of experiences we could throw into that. So I think that's a good idea, because I think that is a population that really needs to understand more if they want to do their job well. So, you in, Mike?
I'm in. Well, I'm about to have another baby. Why not? What
So you have to, every time you have a kid, you write a book? Is that how it works?
Two painful things together.
Well, you know what? It keeps you home, maybe. So, you know, you have to have something else to do since it isn't a good time to respond. So there you go. So is there anything else you want to tell us about the book? Because I know our time's getting kind of short here.
Sure. I think I would add just a few lessons I learned were trying to gain experience that there are other avenues before you get on a disaster that you could go work with a medical group in an underserved area, whether it's here in the United States, a poor area, as a dental clinic, with a medical clinic. I know that here in Southern California, there are groups going to Mexico pretty frequently. And I did one of those trips to the Dominican Republic up in the mountains, you know, probably 8 or 9 years ago. And while it wasn't a disaster, that was a really valuable way for me to realize what it was like with 2 weeks without a hot shower, 2 weeks without electricity, 2 weeks without the comforts that I'm so used to. So there are other ways of getting that experience, which I learned a lot about what gear to pack and how I respond to stress and sleeplessness. So that's kind of a lesson that I learned. Another lesson that I learned was we talked about the stresses on our families. When I was in Nepal, there was a second pretty major aftershock about 3 or 4 days after we were there, and some more people were killed and hurt in that aftershock. And I was lucky the group I was with had a strong communications plan. So we immediately called them on a satellite phone. We said all the members of our team are accounted for, nobody was injured. And they immediately called our families and said, your loved ones are safe. You'll see on the news this morning that there's an aftershock. But I didn't realize that I had a whole kind of second circle of friends and acquaintances and coworkers who weren't part of that initial announcement from our team, and my wife didn't know to call them. And maybe if she had posted something on social media, hey guys, everybody, Mike was fine. But for weeks after I got back from Nepal, I had people stop me in the hallway at work or text me or email me, hey dude, were you hurt in the other aftershock? So that's something I'll throw out there for people. Maybe leave your passwords to your social media with somebody at home so that if you are safe, somebody can post on your behalf and say, hey, something else happened in that area, or give an update every couple of days. That was something I didn't do well, and in retrospect, I'll do it differently in the future.
Well, Jim is kind of our expert on social media and how it translates to disaster. Our team has what we call a home team, So if you can't deploy for some reason, you can engage with the home team. And we had some pretty horrendous experiences going on that were scary in Katrina. And fortunately, that home team, and this was really before social media is what it is today, but they were able to touch base with everybody's family when they started hearing about what was going on. So, Jim, any thoughts on that? We've got a few minutes here.
No, not really. I think it's just a great way to stay in touch with each other and share information, both, you know, from an organizational standpoint with emergency managers. And I know a lot of people are jumping on that wagon when I first met. And so, by far, I appreciate the support, but I don't think I'm an expert. I think Jamie's more the expert than anybody, you and Jamie. Because when you guys drug me into the social media thing, I was like, I'm not even sure what this is, but let's try it. But I think it's a good way to stay in touch with families, organizations, and get that information out, you know, in real time, which is real critical these days.
Exactly. And you can imagine you being the one that's at home, and I've been in there because I couldn't respond to some of these disasters. So, Mike, I know we want to get you out of here on time. Do you have any last words of wisdom?
I would encourage people not to get discouraged. If you feel that you've got something to offer, either as a domestic disaster volunteer here in the United States or as an international disaster volunteer, it doesn't matter if you're 18 years old with very little experience or 65 and retired. If you work hard enough, you'll do it. You'll make it. You'll find a niche for yourself, and you'll be able to help people. So don't get discouraged. I was kind of running in circles 8 or 9 years ago, but I've been able to find some cool opportunities to serve others over the past decade. And you're certainly listening to a podcast like this will take you years ahead of where I wish I was then. You know, I wish I'd had a resource like this to listen to. So thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
Well, thanks for listening. And that's how we got you in the first place. So we'll get you back again when you're out there having more experiences. So Jim, real quick, what's going on with Paragon these days?
Staying busy, so which is a good thing for us. So we're kind of from coast to coast and internationally as well. So we're doing some things. Is Joe still on? I didn't hear. I haven't heard him yet.
No, he's been quiet.
I'm still here.
He's there.
Yeah, there you go. I think Joe's going to Coventry, England pretty soon. We'll be in Vegas. Oh. We're in the southeast. I'm out here teaching a safety course in Emmitsburg, Maryland. So, so we're staying busy.
I want to go with Joe. You want to go, Jenny?
Oh, I always love to hear where they're going. You guys have all the fun. Joe, yeah. If somebody wants to, you know, try to fit themselves into your schedule, where can they reach out to Paragon Medical Education Group and check in to see about the type of training and experience that you can bring to their system?
Well, you absolutely can find us on the web under Paragon Medical Education Group. We have a Facebook page as well. You can reach us through the Disaster Podcast or the Facebook page for the Disaster Podcasts.
Excellent. And thank you for that. And Sam, where can folks find you?
Well, like Joe said, certainly podcast related, disasterpodcast.com or the Facebook page. If you have an interest in a lot of our regular guests, and I hope Mike is either on that or will be, it's easy to get onto that and have some ongoing discussion, as Kyle would say. Social media, you find me at Sam Bradley or Sam Bradley 11 in the usual social media places.
And, of course, you can find me under the handle PodMedic in most of the places out there. So look me up, friend, or follow me. And, of course, you can always find me over at our Disaster Podcast Facebook group. Just search for Disaster Podcast in Facebook and ask to join the group. We'll be happy to let you in. And we have some discussion. We post our episodes over there, and our guests are frequently joining as well. So we can you can ask a question there in the comments. We'd love to have you join us. And of course, also follow us over at disasterpodcast.com. But Sam, I think we got a lot to go, and we can really look at how Mike's experiences can be translated into other people's potential experiences. Mike, is there any way that people want to reach out to you that they can get a hold of you easily?
Absolutely. I set up my own not particularly sophisticated website called internationaldisastervolunteering.com, internationaldisastervolunteering.com. So there is a contact website, contact form right there, and I get questions once a week or so, and I'm happy to answer them or reach out to people. So that's, and the book is also available through Amazon.com and Barnes & Noble and through the publisher, and those links are there as well.
And I'll make sure I have links to the book in the show notes for this episode, and also link to your website so people can get a hold of you. So thanks a lot for coming on the show.
It was my honor. Thank you.
Sam, this kind of gets us to the end of another episode, but boy, what a great source of information Mike is, and I'm looking forward to checking out this book myself.
Exactly, and now we all got another book to write. Like, you're not busy enough writing books, but hey, it's about time we got Jim and Joe going on something like that, and we'll get Mike in there, and there we go. That's our next project. But, you know, this is, we're talking about the Sierra Leone thing and, you know, all of these major disasters that many of us have been involved in, and you know, I think Mike's got a great point. You just got to know what you're getting into. And I think a book like that is going to help them learn and be honest with themselves, hopefully, because just like with everything else we talk about, disaster medicine is not our everyday medicine.